Welcome back to the Free From Wall Street podcast. This is Steven Libman. I have a special replay. Take a listen. Let me know what you think. And don't forget to go to integrityhg.com. Sign up for the investor club so you can see all the deals that we have in our pipeline and what we have done in the past. Welcome to the Free From Wall Street podcast, where we share how we have done over $200 million in real estate deals to create, preserve, and pass on generational wealth without the roller coaster ride of the stock market. If you're ready to start investing with purpose, visit freefromwallstreet.com. But for now, let's dive into this episode.
What's up, guys, and welcome back to the Millennial Real Estate Investor Podcast. We're so happy you're here with us this week, and this should be another fun week where I think we're all going to learn a lot. So without further ado, Steven Libman, welcome to the show.
I'm officially psyched out of my mind.
Awesome. Us too.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you guys having me on. It's going to be fun.
Nice. So before we jump in, like we always try to extract from our guests in some way, let's talk about an interesting or funny real estate story that you've had in your 10 plus years of doing this.
Yeah. So I guess gopher turtles can cost you a couple million dollars if you guys didn't know that. We're building a gopher turtle. Is a gopher tortoise is what it's
called.
All
right. Okay.
So they're huge. There's big tortoises down in Florida, and they have to be moved if you're going to do any construction. So we're building 1,193 unit self-storage complex. It's a $12 million project, and there's a cold snap in Orlando, but there's got to be five consecutive days of 60-degree weather to move these gopher tortoises out of their natural habitat, which is where we're building our storage facility. So we have to wait a week, 2 weeks. We finally get to move them. It takes like 6 weeks to get the report back. So this is all delaying our construction timeline. The appraiser doesn't come out to do the final appraisal until we have the sign-off from the environmental company about these gopher tortoises. Wouldn't you know that the day the appraisal guy comes out, he does a SWOT assessment, right? Strength, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And in his final SWOT analysis, the threat that he put on was a guy across the street who literally just hammered in a sign 6 hours before he got there that said 120,000 rentable square feet of self-storage. That was not there for the last 2 years that we've been getting approvals. So we had to go across the street and buy the guy out. It cost me $2 million because of these tortoises.
So. Oh my gosh.
So that's a little bit interesting, right?
So, all right. First of all, I just learned what a gopher turtle is for the first time. So yeah. Thank you for that one. Second, this guy just decided all of a sudden that he was also going to do self-storage across the street from you. Did he know you guys were going to?
Yeah. So we had our signage up for a while. And I think part of his plan was just, you know, we're going to compete with each other. And there's actually enough demand there to support both deals. The issue was that the bank came back to us and said, hey, now we have another 100,000 square feet of going across the street. You know, we need you to give us another year of interest reserves, and we're going to add a year to your lease up period. So we need another $1 million in reserves. So we went across the street and we said, well, if I got to give $1 million to the bank and have competition, I wonder how much we could buy the place across the street from. So we ended up buying it for $2 million. We created a covered RV and boat storage facility that's a great complement to our current facility. So we were going to spend the money either way, but it'll end up making us more money in the long run, but it did cost us a little bit up front.
That's awesome. I love it. I don't think we've had a story quite like that.
No, I don't think we've had anything with turtles.
People, places, systems, processes, all of those things can cost you money in a deal. Tortoises was not one of the things.
Yeah. I assume we've now added tortoises to our list of.
You better put it on your checklist.
We do. That's right. Need to start putting our like keywords together of like things that will cause you problems with deals. We've had cocaine, human feces, potentially dead bodies, and tortoises. Like, so we'll just add that one in there.
There we go. Awesome. So, Steven, why don't we back up a second and why don't you introduce yourself, who you are, what you do in real estate, and how you got started in real estate?
Sure. So Stephen Libman, I'm a managing partner of Integrity Holdings Group. We're out of New Jersey. We've been in real estate for 10 years. I actually have been in real estate for 12 years. Prior to starting our own investment firm, I was a real estate agent, then a broker, then a managing broker. We were doing a lot of real estate owned, bank owned type properties back in the crash, and started making a lot of money for other investors by sourcing deal flow for them. And one of our investors, I made him probably close to seven figures that year by sourcing really good flips for him. He was really grateful. So the last deal we ever did, he held my feet to the fire for my commission for a $250 pool ladder that disappeared from inspections to closing. And I had to pay for it out of my commission, which was a couple thousand bucks. And that was the last deal I decided to be a broker on, because I figured I could find the deal flow. I saw what these guys were doing in terms of flips. Why couldn't I do it myself? So I actually wrote that guy a nice card and had a great conversation with him a couple months back and thanked him, because without that violent shove into entrepreneurship, I would have probably worked for somebody else for much longer. So became a broker and then ended up stopping doing that. Went down to Costa Rica for about a month with my business partner, wrote a business plan, came back, burned the boats, and decided to start our own wholesale and flip business. We did okay. The first couple of years, we got our teeth kicked in a bit. We had to learn from the ground up. We didn't have any mentors that were in the Jersey Shore area that were doing any type of volume. So we were just kind of piecing it to get together on our own. Started listening to some podcasts 4 or 5 years in. Met some great mentors that were building real businesses, doing hundreds of transactions a year. Joined a single family mastermind group called Seven Figure Flipping, and accelerated our business to doing 15 to 20 deals a month in both the wholesale and fix and flip space. So we finally figured out how to systemize and grow, and built a team of about 15 people at its biggest. And this year we actually sold that business off and shut down the residential business 100% to focus on commercial. In the last 24 months or so, we've acquired about $100 million in assets in the self-storage and multifamily space.
So that's a big change through all of that. So, you know, there's so many people we talk to that they're like, they're still an agent. They're going to continue being an agent. Obviously, like you said, a $250 ladder over for somebody that you made, you know, six to seven figures in a year as far as their profits go. Like, that's just, people do things like that all the time. And that's half the time the broker's job. It's like, just get the damn deal done. It's over. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So
absolutely.
Let's go into the wholesale flipping thing. Obviously, seven-figure flipping, for those of you who haven't heard of that, I know many people have heard of Bill Allen, who isn't Bill the one who runs that mastermind group initially?
Yep, Bill's a great friend of ours, and he now owns and runs that mastermind. And he does a great job of really kind of letting people peek behind the curtain and see how those businesses and how real operators that are still operating those businesses really run those businesses. So it was great. I mean, we were fixing, flipping and wholesaling for 5 years before we found that mastermind and found Bill, and he showed his operations to us, right? Open book. And we just replicated everything he did. And over the next 12 months, we built a seven-figure business, which was incredible. And we continued to do that and build on that. And it was great. We got a lot of great friendships and relationships out of it. The people in that group are, they're very transparent. They're open about what the struggles are in their business. I mean, it's easy for everybody to show you how to build a good business on paper, right? But how much time are you spending with your family? How much time are you able to dedicate to the things that you want to dedicate? So that group gave us a lot of confidence in how to build the business, how to run the business, how to process it, and then also how to build the lifestyle around it that we wanted to, which is what ended up making us shut down that business, ironically enough. So,
well, so you mentioned struggles, and I want to jump into that quickly, because you mentioned getting your teeth kicked in as well, as far as some of your deals go. So before you got into this side of figuring out how to make it more efficient and growing into a bigger business, what were some of those bigger lessons you learned from those first few years of being a flipper wholesaler?
Yeah, so the first thing was, you can't be an island. I think a lot of entrepreneurs feel like they're on an island by themselves. And we did too. And we allowed that to happen. So instead of seeking out people that were doing the business and doing it well, we just wanted to learn the hard way, right? We didn't actually want to, but we didn't know another way. So we just, school of hard knocks, right? Like, oh, let's figure it out in every deal. So the first thing that we didn't know was that you could hire people. Ironically enough, that helps out a lot, right? So Travis and I were just two people. That's my business partner, Travis. We just had two people doing everything, right? The reason that this all started, by the way, was Travis made his third trip to Home Depot in one day on a flip that we were doing. And he called me up and he was like, what are we doing? He's like, you know, how many deals can we do? This is not scalable. So that's how we started looking into how other people were doing it. How do we scale our real estate investment business? Because the two of us can't do everything, right? I'm raising money. I'm trying to find deals. We weren't doing any off-market deal flow yet. We were just doing MLS. So I was making, I don't know, 10, 15 offers a day. And as a broker, I'm negotiating on our behalf. We're making a bunch of offers, making a lot of people upset with us in the process, right? Because we're not doing a great job of explaining our business model yet. We're just making stupid offers. So that was a learning curve. How do I let other agents know that I'm not just making offensive offers, that this is my business model and that I am a real cash buyer? So that was a learning curve. So, you know, what we did and what we did wrong, I think, was thinking, one, that we could do everything ourselves. Two, not really telling the story appropriately. And I think this is probably a problem for a lot of newer wholesalers. They don't know how to explain their business. So they over-explain it or they under-explain it. They don't do a great job of explaining to other agents how they can help them make more money.
What is the right balance there? So I want to keep going on this track, but what is the right balance in that middle? Because I think you're right. Either it gets way over-explained or they say nothing.
Yeah, so I think it's honesty and transparency without adding confusion. Right. So you have to understand what the goal of the real estate agent is. It's to get an offer. It's to negotiate that offer and to get a deal done. They don't need to know the inner workings of your business, that you're going to contract it and then send it out to a bunch of people and you're not really the end buyer. It's sometimes you are the end buyer. Sometimes you aren't. Right. It doesn't affect the A to B contract. And you need to have that conversation with the agent. You say, hey, look, I'm a cash buyer. I can't pay what you're offering, but I can make you a realistic offer. What's the motivation of the estate or the owner that's selling? Why are they selling? Can you be a disclosed dual agent for me? Would you represent both sides, right? What I like about that is they represent me and they represent you. So they represent nobody, right? They can't have a fiduciary responsibility to either party. So they're just now acting as a go-between and you get to actually negotiate the deal. So I like getting them both sides of the commission, right? So that they can make more money. And then also take them out of that negotiation process a little bit by just passing on terms and really digging into what the motivation of the owner is and why they want to sell. Sure. And then, you know, letting them know, hey, I need this 14 or 21 day or 30 day inspection period, whatever you're going to negotiate. And during that time frame, I'm going to come in. I'm going to try to just come in once with all of my investors and construction management guys and my subs. And, you know, we're going to swarm the house one day, but it's so I don't have to call you every single day for the next 30 days and get 30 different people in there. I'm going to try to set it up in one fell swoop, and then we're going to get in and out of your hair. And then after that day, you'll know whether or not we're going to be able to move forward. Right. So just keep it clean, keep it clear, keep it concise. And then if they get interested and really try to understand what your business is, then on a case by case basis, you can have those conversations. What I found is that if you build 4 or 5 really solid relationships with realtors, and those are the ones that are selling a lot of distressed properties, then you're going to be just fine. You'll find enough deal flow.
Yeah.
And then past that, right, as you start to learn how to market direct to consumer, then you take them out of that conversation altogether.
Sure. So you said at the time you guys were doing all MLS. I assume that means at some point you moved into more off-market deals. What did that shift look like and why did it happen? Like, did the MLS start drying up?
No, it was, I think there's always deals on the MLS. I think that a combination of both strategies is important to lower your cost per contract, but the MLS was very crowded. We're in Central Jersey. There's a lot of multi multiple offers on certain good deals. So we were just getting beat out. And especially as wholesalers, we needed to buy it under what the guys we were competing for were buying them. So it became a little bit of a struggle to find enough deal flow, you know, for us to continue to scale. So we added in some direct mail marketing strategies, some PPC strategies. You know, the biggest thing with that is how many deals do you want to do? I mean, I think there's plenty of, if you were looking to do, you know, one or two deals a month, there's plenty of deals on the MLS for you. We were doing 20 deals a month by the time we shut the business down. So you need a lot of leads to be able to close that many deals a month. So there's just not, there's not enough capacity on the MLS.
Yeah, absolutely.
And something, so going back then, you were, the whole point of shutting this business down was a lifestyle thing. You were building up, so you had a business that could support the lifestyle you wanted, but then you didn't have the ability to have that lifestyle, I'm assuming, with family, other things of the sort.
It was threefold, right? One, it was a very transactional business, so it wasn't passive in any capacity. It wasn't creating the passive income that would allow me to continue to live the lifestyle. So I built myself a job, right? High-paying job, but a transactional job and a very highly taxed job. So we always knew that we'd move into more passive income. We just didn't know whether that was going to be single-family duplexes, quads, or 220-unit complexes. We just didn't know, right? So as we started getting around mentors, and we learned our lesson, right, in the wholesale fix and flip business to not go embark on this new journey without talking to some people. So we went and talked to some people. We talked to plenty of guys in Jersey that own 200 units of one to four family and what that looks like, what the property management side of that looks like, what kind of job did they create by doing it. Then we talked to guys who own $250 million worth of assets across the country in large scale multifamily deals. Well, why did they do that? And then the straw that really breaks the camel's back on this is taxes. You know, we were giving 40 to 50% away to Uncle Sam on every single deal that we did in the single family space. We'll do well over seven figures this year and pay zero federal tax this year in the multifamily space. So when you start to understand how money works, how the IRS tax code works, and what you get to keep after what you get to earn, and the ability to spend more time with your family because it's more passive, you couple all of those things together and it was a no-brainer.
Okay, so I want to pause there for a second because I love that point. And I think some people who are new to real estate don't always understand that. The point on taxes on multifamily and commercial versus flipping single-family homes. So can you, for those who don't know, can you dive into that a little bit more? Because when you say you guys will pay zero in federal taxes, I think a lot of people who haven't been around real estate for a long time look at that and go, what? Like, that's cheating. There's no way that can happen. But yeah, it's all part of the tax code and it's there for a reason. So yeah, can you dive into that a little bit?
Sure. So Tax-Free Wealth by Tom Wheelwright is a book that every real estate investor should be reading. It changes your mindset on taxes. I think a lot of us as W-2 employees or initially entrepreneurs look at the tax code as something that is a bunch of rules to take money out of your pocket, right? Or to potentially get you audited and get you in trouble. The tax code basically says two things. One, I'm the government, I can tax you on whatever I want. Two, I can also give you deductions for whatever you want. And the rest of the tax code is how to take those deductions legally. So the government's tax code is basically a book of incentives to get you to do what they want you to do, and they incentivize you to do so, right? So if they want me to buy multifamily housing, they're going to give me massive tax deductions on buying multifamily housing. If they want me to start a business with 500 or more employees, they'll give me massive tax deductions to start a business with more than 500 employees. So once you change your perspective on what the tax code is actually telling you, then you get to start to look at it in a different way, right? Now the tax code isn't scary to me. Now it's a book of how to not pay taxes. So if you read Tax-Free Wealth by Tom Wheelwright, he does a great job of laying this out. And there's a couple of ways that they show you how to do it, but especially if you're a real estate investor or a real estate professional, when you couple the tax strategies of multifamily, even with your single family fix and flip business or wholesale business, it'll offset the majority of your taxes. Right. So quick example, 17, 18, 19, we did pretty well. We spent maybe $400,000 in collective taxes that we had to pay to the government. Right. And that was after the tax code changed. So it was still in a low tax bracket in comparison to what they used to be. The CARES Act, because we're in pandemic times, the CARES Act now allows for what they call a net operating loss carryback. So for 2020, we're taking on about 500 new units, we should write off about $10 million in depreciation. We'll circle back to what that looks like. That means I'll clear all of the income this year that I can clear tax-free. But the CARES Act is now allowing me to carry that money back, those losses, backwards. So I'm actually getting a refund from the IRS for all of the taxes that I paid in 17, all the taxes I paid in 18, all the taxes I paid in 19 as a check. I mean, the government's cutting me a check for all the taxes that I paid when I was flipping because of the losses that I'm taking in the multifamily space. And then whatever's left over, I can carry forward in perpetuity until I continue to use it. Wow. There is recapture that you have to pay when you sell these properties back. And, you know, I'm not a CPA, but there's massive losses that you can take every time you buy a property. Eventually, you'll have to pay some of them back unless, of course, you're offsetting it with a new acquisition that year, blah, blah, blah. So just huge opportunities to pay little to no tax in the real estate world. And this is nothing new. I mean, if you remember watching the debate between Trump and Hillary, at one point she brought up the tax returns and how he refuses to show them. I'll tell you what they say. He didn't pay any taxes because he acquires massive commercial real estate. So he didn't pay any federal tax. And he leans into the microphone at one point and he says, it makes me smart. And it doesn't make him smart. It makes the CPAs follow the tax law.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because it's built for that reason. It's built so that people make the right actions that the government wants them to take. And, right. You know, hopefully that's beneficial to society as a whole.
Yeah, hopefully. Right. I mean, we get to manage complexes that have hundreds of families that live into them. Right. So we're going to go in and we're going to make them nice and safe and well lit and a nice, clean place to live. So hopefully that makes society better.
Thank you so much for listening to the Free from Wall Street podcast. We're excited that you're listening and tuning in every week, but we want to have a two-way conversation with you, not just a one-way conversation. So go to integrityhg.com/webinar and join us on one of our weekly webinars where you can meet me, meet the team, have a conversation, and let's really talk about your investing goals and how we can help.
So, all right, let's go back to kind of the route that Dan was going down a minute ago. So as you continued this, building this massive flipping and wholesaling business, and then realized one day that you and your partner are making too many Home Depot trips and you can't do anything else. What did the transition look like after you talked to all these people and tried to get a bearing on what worked for what you wanted out of your life? What happened next?
So the third Home Depot trip that day is what we realized we needed to scale. How do we scale? So we started getting around guys like Bill Allen and talking about how to hire, how to fire, how to scale. What positions are we going to hire for first? You know, what's the most bang for your buck? So that was a big learning curve, right? So we had to hire an acquisition person. And we started sending mail and then we found out that acquisition person wasn't closing deals and we were burning a lot of marketing dollars. And so I was doing acquisitions. So there's a big learning curve there, right? So if you're not in a mastermind or you're not with mentors, it's the easiest way to cut the line, right? Is to figure out what they did, what mistakes they made, and how you can avoid them, which is what we did. We paid, you know, a good amount of money to get into that group, but it made us $1 million business. Mm-hmm. So there are some challenges that you have to go through, the growing pains of hiring and scaling. And it created a new set of problems for us, which was, I'm not a good manager. So my business partner is better at creating systems and processes, but I thought, hey, I'm the people person. I should be managing these people, but I'm not. I'm a visionary, so I don't hold people accountable to anything. But I have the expectation that they'll hold themselves accountable to what my expectations are. It's completely unreasonable. but it was a new challenge that was very real. So we knew that we needed to hire a chief operating officer, somebody that could come in and create the systems and the processes and then hold those people accountable to those systems and processes. And this all kind of came to a head at the same time about 3 years ago, where we hired our chief operating officer, Sean. He came in. We knew that the transition would be 6 to 12 months to get him completely autonomous. And we were at the same time closing our first and second commercial real estate deals. And we had to make a decision, which was, how much time can we spend training the chief operating officer when we're also now half, you know, half in this boat and half in this boat, half in the commercial boat, half in the residential boat? And should we, right? I think the hardest question that an entrepreneur needs to ask themselves is, should I continue doing this? Not can you, because you can muscle through anything, but did it make more sense to kind of take the team down to a skeleton crew and just focus 100% on the commercial side of the business, which is where we truly wanted to be, right? Less taxes, more passive income, more time with my family, less transactional. And we just happened to be in the timing of, do we spend and sow a lot more time into our chief operating officer and get them autonomous? Or do we pull the plug and the ripcord and say, no, we're going to go over this way? And it was a very difficult decision because, one, that business was running, right? We were making money on it. But I knew that spending another 6 or 12 months getting my COO autonomous and letting him run the wholesale flip business was also going to distract me from finding new deals, new investors, and new opportunities in the multifamily space. So, you know, we went out for a beer, sat down and said, what should we do here, right? We have a big team. Do we fire 10 people and just go it alone and pivot the business? And eventually that's what we decided to do, was make that leap.
It's got to be a tough call when a business is running successfully and all of a sudden you're going to let it go.
It was terrifying. I mean, we spent 10 years building a business so that it would work. We got it to work and then realized we didn't want to do that business anymore. You know, So it was, you know, and my wife and all of our families, we went through this together, right? I mean, the first couple of years was really tough. I mean, I took a big pay cut from becoming a broker to flipping houses because we had to learn that business. We finally learned it, systemized it, figured out how to do it, and it was making money. And then it was like, no, this isn't exactly what we want.
Right.
So, right. Yeah, it was tough.
I'm sure the families have benefited significantly, though, since this shift away from that business and probably away from being a broker as well.
Night and day. I mean, you know, our personal financial statements have, you know, 10x'd since we shut down the wholesale flip business because we were making money, right? But we weren't adding anything to our net worth because we didn't own anything. We were just turning and burning capital, right? So we had a job, but it wasn't creating any passive income or net worth for us. So yeah, it's very different business. We had to learn, you know, how to, what I love about this multifamily business though, is many hands make light work and you don't get into it by yourself. So we partnered with people that had $100 to $200 million of assets under management right out of the gate. Right. So we brought money to those deals. We brought talent to those deals. We started adding value to those deals, but we weren't on our own. We were partnered with people that have been doing it for a decade. So we get to learn from within, build our net worth, and create passive income at the same time.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So I'm curious, as you made this shift, I think one of the things that, you know, people who are either in a corporate job that pays well or, you know, flipping houses, I think one of the things that's hardest is getting into commercial and multifamily. Sometimes the upfront payoff can be further down the road. So did you guys have like a crossing the bridge moment of like, you know, we're turning all this capital quickly, we're getting paid really well, and once we make this cutoff, we're going to have to wait a while till the next paycheck. What did that look like?
Well, so paid really well is subjective, right? Because we had a ton of overhead in that business too. I mean, at one point we were spending $15,000 a week in marketing costs, right? I mean, it was eating cash too. So it was making cash, but it was eating cash. And that was what was scary about that business was one wrong hire can put us 150 grand in debt in almost no time. So what we decided to do was we turned the marketing machine way down, let a bunch of people go. And then I continued to do acquisitions for us for about 12 weeks. And instead of wholesaling those deals, we used our own capital and wholetailed those deals, right? So wholesale, retail, I don't know if you guys use that terminology of wholetailing. So we would take the property down and we would just lipstick it and put it back on the market, not do heavy lifts, but just do, you know, not even paint and carpet, literally just like paint and put it back on the market. And instead of our average wholesale fee of $18,000, we'd make an average wholetail fee of $35,000. right? So what we were doing was paying off some of the unsecured capital that we still had lingering in the business and taking paychecks and securing some of our financial future so that we didn't have to continue to do it longer than we did. So that was kind of the bridge that we did. So I was still doing maybe 4 or 5 appointments a week on my own, right? I was still doing some very light mailing. It would relate to 4 to 5 appointments a week. It would relate to 1 to 2 deals a week. So we were still making a couple $100,000 a month, but with way less overhead. So it just, it went a lot further. So it carried us until we got maybe our next large acquisition fee from a commercial acquisition.
Sure. That makes sense. So, and you've talked about a couple things here. Once you went the commercial route, we've heard obviously self-storage units, and turtles. We've heard about multifamily. What did you guys start with? Was it multifamily first and then you shifted into other things?
No. So our first deal was that 1,193 unit ground up self-storage development. It was CubeSmart managed. It's just come online now. We're leasing up. We're about 25% leased up at this point. It, you know, those are a little bit longer processes. So that was our first deal. And then the second and third deal, the second deal, you know about, we had to go buy the guy out across the street. So that happened very quick and unexpected and not by really our own doing. Luckily, it'll make us some money and it saved us a competitive edge. And then we found a third self-storage facility, same, about 130,000 square feet ground up, about 8 miles from the first facility. So the first three deals we did, we did non-cash flowing ground up development deals, which is difficult, right? Because we don't have cash flow from the fix and flip business anymore. And then we moved into more value add multifamily. So those are the two asset classes that we knew we wanted to be in. They're the most... They have a lot more downside hedge against risk, right? They're more recession resistant than other asset classes. People always need a place to live. And when people get kicked out of their houses, self-storage is the only asset class that tends to increase in value. So in 2008, 2009, when people were losing their homes, self-storage actually increased in value by 5% per year. So it's a recession resistant asset class, and then multifamily, same thing, class B, class C assets, even during pandemic like this, it's actually increasing our value versus decreasing it. So those are the only two asset classes we participate in. We don't mess with retail. We don't mess with office. We don't mess with, even industrial is doing great right now, but we don't understand that asset class enough to go into it.
So you brought up something a little bit ago that you mentioned your complex is managed by CubeSmart.
Yeah. So CubeSmart is the third largest real estate investment trust in the country. They run about 40 million square feet across the country, but they third party manage about 20% of that. So they own and operate about 80%, but they actually brand and third party manage, like a property manager, about 20% of that portfolio.
Wow. I had no idea. When I, you know, when you drive around, you see CubeSmart or any of the other big self-storage companies, I always figured they own it, they manage it, it's all theirs. I had no idea that they rebranded and managed other people's properties as well. So is it a higher fee? I don't even know if you can pay like a, you know, like you would in multifamily, a property manager by themselves to manage
exactly,
it.
It's exactly what we do. So we pay salaries to the people in the front office and we pay 4.5% management fee and they give us management reports every month, lease up reports. It's very similar to the multifamily property management space.
Wow. Wow. And actually, I'm sure very efficient because they do 40 million square feet across the country.
Well, and it's a great exit strategy too, right? Because they're a REIT, so they typically pay a little bit more than your typical buyer. And they've looked under the hood. They've leased it up. They know exactly where they need to be. They know what their operational costs are. So, you know, the problem with deciding to brand up front is that you will get very few competitive bids when you go sell it, right? Life Storage and Public Storage are not coming in to give me an offer when CubeSmart's branded it and ran it. But CubeSmart is the number one manager and owner in Florida. So that's why we went with them. They just paid for a brand new Class A project right down the street from us, 50% occupied. They paid a 4.5 cap. If they do that for us, it would be amazing. So
yeah.
but yeah, so they they come in, they manage, we manage the managers, they're doing the reporting and everything, and it gives us kind of that hands-off, more passive approach.
Gotcha. Gotcha. That's really cool. So before we start heading into the last part of the show, where do you see your business going in the next few years? What's the plan going forward?
Yeah, so our tagline is invest with purpose. So in every deal that we do, we actually give an equity position to a nonprofit. So in just the deals we've done in the last 18 months, we've committed over $1 million in giving to those nonprofits through our deal flow. The next three deals that we're closing in the next couple of months here will produce between $700,000 and $800,000 in passive income over the next 5 years for those nonprofits that we partner with. So the heart behind the business is really to give abundantly to, you know, the level of need that exists in the world. And the people that invest with us, they get to partner in that with us, you know? So we really wanted to get into passive income to create some semblance of a lifestyle for us, right? Create, preserve, and pass on generational wealth to us and our families. But the real heart behind this is to be able to give just aggressively and abundantly through all of these deals. So we have about 125 investors in our group so far that have partnered. We'll have another about 70 over the next three deals that we're closing. So about 200 people get to participate in the benefits of what it looks like to give millions of dollars away to different organizations that are digging wells in West Africa, saving girls from sex trafficking in the Middle East. You know, we're building a 100% disabled park here in New Jersey for that's 100% wheelchair accessible for baseball fields, bocce courts, mini golf, swings, playground sets. So, you know, we get to do some really incredible things through these deals. So the vision is to continuing to increase the level of equity that we give away to these nonprofits. On every deal, we try to go up by at least 1% equity share, so that we get to give more and more passively and more abundantly. And, so that's really the goal. The next 10 years is going to be just continuing to find great deals that create value for our investors and for ourselves, create consistent, stable returns that are predictable for the investors and also some predictable cash flow for these nonprofits.
Nice. I love it. I hope you guys do keep growing exponentially so that you can keep doing that. That's really cool.
Appreciate that.
So let's roll into the last couple questions of the show, starting with, if you had the chance to send a message back to your 16-year-old self, what would it be?
I think, just understanding how money works is a big deal that you shouldn't be learning in your 30s, right? Or 40s. Compound interest is really the eighth wonder of the world. And if you can figure out a way to live below your means and invest into the types of deals that are not Wall Street, right? And that are types of real estate transactions that give you consistent 8, 10, 12% returns, then you can be financially free much sooner than I think the world tells you to. I have a YouTube channel for Integrity Holdings Group. We did a YouTube video called Millionaire Kids, and my six-year-old has invested in our self-storage complexes. And we calculate out when she'll be a millionaire by just by compounding that same investment over and over again.
Yeah.
And I wish I understood what debt and equity and compound interest looked like in high school, because I'd be much further ahead. And I know that I'm further ahead at even 38 than a lot of people will be ever in their lives. But this is something that I think we need to educate people about, that financial freedom is not set apart for a select few. That the education that you can give yourself and that other people can give you on what financial opportunities there are can really set you free early.
Nice. All right. So, other than meeting great people, what's one big unexpected benefit you found from real estate investing?
I mean, the ability to give back way more than I'd ever be able to do by myself is something that has come across in the last couple of years. I mean, I think all of us have a heart for giving in some capacity, whether it's to just causes that are near and dear to our heart, or, you know, to bigger organizations that kind of do a bunch of different things. But what I love about the multifamily space and the commercial space is, just like you have to go far together, right, or go fast alone, you get to give way more together than we'd ever be able to do alone. So I always had this idea of, hey, when I make it to here, I'll give X. And that idea was shattered through real estate because I got to see how in every deal we do, we get to give way more than I'd ever be able to do personally. So that was a real pleasant surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. So when a friend walks up to you today and asks for advice on getting started, what piece of advice do you give them?
So it's kind of a loaded question, right? They need to know at least what that looks like. What do you mean by get started? By creating passive income, by flipping a house, by wholesaling a house? Like, what exactly do you want to do? And why do you want to do it is kind of the next question that begs the next answer. But I get where you're going. And I think the easiest answer to that question is find somebody who's doing what you want to do and try to go add value to them. We live in a very interesting time now with podcasts and YouTube channels, and a lot of people have great platforms. You're probably only one, two, maybe three connections away from being connected with the person that is doing or living very similarly to what you want to do. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. There's nothing new under the sun. So find your tribe, right? Find those people that are doing what you want to do and try to add some value to them. Ask them questions. And by adding value, by the way, you don't have to go and tell them how to run their business that they're already successful at. Go add value to them and say, hey, can I take you out to dinner, right? Can I take you out to lunch? Can I pay for a lunch? Can I, you know, if you haven't read John Ruland's book, Giftology, there's a great way to cut the line and get in front of basically anybody, whoever you want, by just giving a gift, right? So there's some interesting ways to get in front of the people that can offer a ton of value. And most of the people that I know that are successful in life and in business are willing to share everything with you. I mean, everybody that I've met that's successful is really an open book if you can get a couple minutes of their time. So don't think you have to go at it alone, right? Go find somebody that's doing what you do and ask them what they're doing.
Wonderful tip there. All right. So what's one app that you use pretty consistently you'd recommend to others?
So we use Voxer a lot just to communicate internally with the team. It's like a walkie-talkie. So I guess WhatsApp, and you can probably now voice text, but for whatever reason, we like using Voxer internally just for quick messages back and forth. We celebrate little wins in like a team Voxer together, like, hey, we just had this happen, or hey, we just had this happen. And I think it's important in the day-to-day drudgery of business. Sometimes you can get caught up in the problems. So it's important, I think, to be able to quickly celebrate wins together.
Yeah, I like that advice. What's one book other than Rich Dad Poor Dad that you'd recommend for anybody looking to invest in real estate?
So I think Never Split the Difference. Actually, I just saw that on your webpage, right, where people are buying that through you guys too. Everything in life is a negotiation, right, is what Chris Voss says. We got to spend a day with him in New York with us and our team. And it's just a great way to start changing your purview of life, right? How to communicate effectively. So I would say Never Split the Difference has helped me in life and in business.
Yeah, love that book. That is why it is front and center on our webpage for so long.
I think
long
I've
now.
Listened to it 7 times now. Yeah. And it's required reading for anybody that gets hired on our team.
Yeah, so absolutely. Cool. Well, all of that will be up in the show notes. As always, guys, just like you can normally get to it at millennial-realestate.com. Click on the shows tab and you can find it there. Steven, where can people find out more about you, your company, and get in touch?
Yes, you can listen to us on our podcast, Free From Wall Street, and you can go to our website, integrityhg.com. Integrity Holdings Group is the name of the company, so reach out to us anywhere on social or directly through that webpage, and we'll be more than happy to talk to people about anything we can help them add value to.
Cool. All right. Well, Steven, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for sharing some wisdom and coming on and telling a good turtle story with us, too.
Always. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. We're going to send out t-shirts every day.
That's right. All right. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Free From Wall Street podcast. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review and let us know what you think.